I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement. And my guest today is Trish Brarsma.
The essential work of writing into your mythic life is to encourage a radical, fundamental reorientation of ourselves to the world around us. Work with Horses accomplishes this by giving us experiences that connect us with our higher selves. It energizes us for pursuing our greatest dreams and hopes. We come to treat everything as sentient. We participate in growing a membrane that is a kind of web embracing the earth, increasing in density and activating new consciousness. We understand how things fit together in one great story, a story of evolution of a new era. We join with other great specialists of spirit who are leading people into their full potential. We become pilgrims of the future, each here to bring some dream into reality by living our own journey to the fullest. The turtle tells me to remember, to slow down, and engage this deeper purpose of my partnership with horses.
A certified therapeutic riding instructor, Patricia Brarsma founded and directed the Saddle Light Center, a nonprofit therapeutic riding program in San Antonio, Texas. She went on to reestablish, direct, and act as head instructor for Hope Equestrian Center in Ashland, Oregon. She has been a certified instructor with the North American Riding for the Handicapped, NARHA, since 1997, and is president of the Equine Facilitated Mental Health Association. She lives in Ashland, Oregon. Welcome, Trish.
Thank you.
Trish, you have written a book called Riding Into Your Mythic Life, and you are a horse person.
I am.
And how long have you been working with horses?
As long as I can remember. At least I was playing with horses as a child, and I started working with horses more professionally as I left high school, I suppose.
So, riding into your mythic life.
Mm-hmm.
So you talk about, in the book, about myth as a new aspect of self.
Right.
What do you mean by that?
Well, many people think of myth is having to do with a story, ancient story, and it is partly that. But the mythic aspect of the self is that part of the self that responds to those myths. It's the one who recognizes the great elements of the old stories. And coded in those old stories are aspects of the human journey, of what it means to be human. And the mythic level of the self is that part of ourselves that is storied, you might say. It's the one that responds to the ancient stories. It's the one that is visited by the gods and goddesses of the ancient stories and is given expression most clearly in those symbolic tales. It's based on my studies with Jean Houston, who really understands the self as having four levels, the first being the physical sensory self, and the second being the psychological historical self, which has to do with our, you know, the places we grew up, our personality patterns. And then the third level of the self is the mythic level of the self, which has to do with that aspect that relates symbolically to our world. And it's, you know, it has to do with some of the larger patterns that we live out of. For instance, I particularly relate to what some people think of as the Athena archetype. And Carl Jung's work has made much of this, the mythic world, familiar to us, along with many others. But he, in particular, in his work with archetypes, enabled us to understand that we all live out of these vast, larger patterns. So myth and story allows us to tap into those larger patterns of the self, and so that we can live that larger life that we often lose sight of in our modern world.
Well, it's real easy for our imagination to get sucked up into the television and
right.
into advertising and, oh, you should buy that and get that because then you'll be all better. But you're not talking about that. You're talking about something very, very different than that.
Yeah, in fact, for you to mention the imagination is really key because the mythic life dwells in particular in the imagination. And in our modern world, often we experience a kind of paucity of the imagination because of some of the things you mentioned. And much of my book has to do with enabling us to claim the rich treasure of our imaginations, that part of our brain-mind system that has been compromised in many cases. And much of it has to do with allowing the parts of ourselves that have that rich imaginative aspect to be enhanced. And horses are really wonderful at allowing us to do that. They have their own special sensitivities to the environment, to subtle energies in the environment. Because of their being a prey animal, they wouldn't have survived all these centuries if they hadn't developed those sensings. And so being around horses with that respect for their special sensitivities, then you can develop the same kind of sensitivity in learning to communicate with them. And much of my book has exercises in it to teach people how to do that.
Looking at that, and that looks real interesting because some of these books, you know, you read them and they say, well, you can do X or you can do Y, but they don't say how.
Mm-hmm.
And these exercises you've tested with people you've taught?
Right. Mm-hmm. Especially with teenagers, but with adults as well. And we've actually done others as well, but I put the most, what I consider the most powerful and sort of cornerstone exercises in the book so that others can actually experience them. In many cases, you don't have to own a horse. Because, again, they're working with the imagination and developing that aspect. But others are, you know, more powerful with a horse, certainly, because it relies on their special capabilities, their special sensitivities, their special intelligences. And, you know, so if you don't own a horse, you might go out and take a few lessons and mm-hmm. and spend some time with a friend's horse or whatever, and just have a chance to explore what it is that, I've often felt that anyone who has thrilled to the sight of a horse, whether it's on television or in real life, they have stepped for a moment into their mythic life with that experience, that connection with a horse. And if they just blow on the embers of that excitement, that attraction to horses, then they'll find themselves stepping into their own mythic life. And so, you know, if someone doesn't have any interest at all in horses, then they might not find anything of value in this book. But you don't have to own a horse is the point. You just need to feel some thrill of that mythic connection with a horse. And, you know, it's because horses have been associated in our imagination with so many grand stories. They're the steed upon which heroes went forth, the carried soldiers into battle, and so we associate them with grand tales. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly the Lord of the Rings had Shadowfax as a key figure, and
Bill the pack horse.
Yeah, there's all kinds of wonderful stories where that honors the mythic role of the horse in the human journey. They partnered with us in so many ways, and it's my feeling that, you know, they may have started as a food source and then morphed into being, for military purposes and then farming and more recently for sports purposes. But I really have experienced through my work in therapeutic riding that horses are stepping into an entirely different role as one who is teaching us how to partner, how to learn about deep partnership. Because ever since I saw the Earth from space in 1969, I was seized by the vision and the possibility of what it means to be one world, that we all have to learn to get along together if we are going to make it in this beautiful blue planet that we are a part of. And horses, I feel like, have stepped up as part of that evolutionary call to allow us to learn how to get along together. If we can learn to communicate with a horse cross-species-wise, then we're going to learn the skills that we need to communicate with other people in other cultures, you see. It's the same skills that that I've been teaching teenagers and adults through this work with horses, that they can take into other situations in their lives. And then, two, that connection with a horse often catapults people into what it means to be a global citizen. And that's where, in my own experience, where my riding in perfect attunement with horse through, especially with Violet Emerald, whose story I tell in the book, she's kind of her life and death are kind of the cornerstones of the book. But it was really through her, my riding her in her peak years, when she was 7 or 8 years old, where we would ride out into the fields, the polo fields that we had access to in San Antonio, and there was just a perfect attunement that would happen over and over again, where my slightest movement would be reflected in her shifting her balance, her weight, and it was an exhilarating experience, and I truly see now, looking back, that it was from that attunement with her that I was suddenly open to a mystical experience that was actually, at the time, kind of overwhelming and astonishing, but it was through that physical attunement with another being that my boundaries were being slowly sort of melted, away, and so that at one point, I suddenly experienced a real visionary and mystical experience, and so I think that there is that potential for many people with horses, and that kind of an experience happens to people of all in all kinds of situations, and I believe that it's an evolutionary leap that we're all taking to have that kind of experience of oneness with our world, with that which is outside of us normally, and that's increasingly the kind of consciousness that we need to bring to bear in solving the challenges that we have before us.
My goodness, she was quite a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Violet Emerald was. We're going to have to take a short break here in just a moment. And I do want to talk with you after the break about attuning the self to the subtle communication, because that's one of the major chapters you have, major parts of the book. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and we are talking with my guest Trish Broersma, and she has written a book called Riding Into Your Mythic Life. And how can people get a hold of you, Trish?
You can go to my website at TrishBroersma.com, TrishBroersma.com, and there's contact information there.
Great. And we're going to take a short break, and we're going to be right back.
All right.
So stay tuned. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and we're talking with my guest, Trish Broersma. And Trish has written a book called Riding Into Your Mythic Life, Transformational Adventures with the Horse. And before the break, Trish, you were talking to us about your equine teacher, Violet Emerald, and how you and she became more or less one being.
Mm-hmm.
She taught you a lot, you said, about how to do that. And can you tell us more about attuning the self with subtle communication?
I think I learned a lot about that issue by working with teenagers. Most of the teens that I worked with were very oriented towards communicating verbally, and they really hadn't grasped what it meant to utilize their body language to its fullest potential. They knew about such things, but they hadn't really explored it. You know, part of what it means to be a teenager is that your body's suddenly doing a lot of things that you're not used to. And so often there's, you know, let's wait, you know. And so working with horses and teenagers was thrilling because after the initial work with a teenager with a horse of learning safety and basic communication skills in terms of leading the horse and
what side to get on and
right.
how to put the saddle on and the bridle.
The basic riding skills, we would teach that in the context of really listening to the horse, noticing how the horse was responding, like in terms of his ears moving, the eye, the horse's body language, and also approaching the horse for grooming or saddling with an attitude of asking permission. So all of that was kind of a foundation for their experience with trying to communicate more subtly with the horse and learning the importance of their body language. And so it essentially would come down to, for instance, an exercise of working in a round pen, it's usually about 30 to 50 feet across, circular pen. And the student would go into the arena with the horse. First, though, just noticing how the state of their own body, just scanning their body, noticing how they felt, and then walking into the arena with the horse and just paying attention to what happens, whether the horse approaches them, how they feel about approaching the horse, and then perhaps asking the horse to move on, to walk, or, you know, to move away from them.
Because there's a certain horse etiquette. I mean, if you approach, then that's a different thing, and if the horse approaches, it's a different.
That's
it
right.
means different
uh-huh.
communication.
Right, and so they learn to start noticing in themselves how they're communicating, especially if they start to make an intentional request of the horse. For instance, that they want the horse to move around the arena in a circle while they're standing in the middle. Often, you know, they are just totally not sure how to communicate that, even though I may have demonstrated it, but to use their arms, their body language, focus their energy in very intentionally on that request.
And that's a big animal.
It's often they might be intimidated. They might be thinking about what they'd rather be doing at that moment. And the horse is going to respond to the subtext that they're standing there with. They may be raising their arm and saying, walk on. But if they don't have their whole self behind it, the horse is going to stand there and say, yeah, what else do you have to say? And it's often, you know, once the student gets their whole self involved and their energy communicating very clearly with their body what they want that horse to do, the horse will invariably cooperate. And so it's often very, it's often very revealing for them to reflect on why the horse isn't responding in the way that they wanted, or, you know, all kinds of interactions are possible because the horse is responding with a much larger palette of subtle awareness, where the student is often they need to learn that.
And as a culture, we've really lost that.
Right. In many cases, especially with our preoccupation with technology, it tends to encourage us to lose track of that.
And it really is isolating. And mm-hmm. when you're interacting with a video game or something, you don't necessarily interact physically or emotionally with someone else. It's right. your experience that's in that story, and it's just, you know, centered on you because mm-hmm. that's the only one there.
Right.
There's not another being standing over there interacting with you.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I think there's something to be said for a lot of the imaginative game playing that does go on, and especially the ones where you're creating worlds, because there is a kind of interaction and a creative aspect to that that can develop the imagination in really helpful ways. But for it to take the place of interaction with other people and other beings is certainly not something we'd want to forget.
You know? Yeah, you talk and you say in your mind on page 51, and I wrote this down because it was quite profound, the language of the mind gives way to a language that lies in the heart and the body. Mm-hmm. We are often led into relationship. We are as often led into relationship as often as we lead. And you have a story of Madison and the mayor.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell us about Madison and the mayor?
Yeah, Madison was she was one of the horses in our lesson program. And one of the early exercises we do with the teenagers was to bring, this was after they've, spent some time grooming the horse, leading the horse, and learning basic safety procedures.
And is this in your adventure camp that
you put
on? Yeah,
this is with the, it was called Equus Libre. It was a program we did with at-risk teens. So we'd put the eight students, either girls or boys, in the arena with two of our trusted horses. It was in a game format, the idea being that they were to work with the horse to get the horse to go over a very low jump that's about a foot high called a cavalletti. But they couldn't touch the horse and they couldn't bribe the horse. And so they could also, however, ask six questions of the volunteers and staff who were present. And most of the time, being teenagers, they hardly ever wanted to ask advice. But this one particular time, it was a group of girls, and they spent a good bit of time with Madison. Gunner, the other horse, had within a minute or two gone over the cavalletti, because being a willing and friendly guy, he was just happy to do pretty much what anybody asked. But Madison walked up to the cavalletti and basically just stood there with her feet against it, and they tried everything they could think of, and she just stared at him like, come on, you've got to do better than this. And basically what was happening was that these girls weren't willing to cooperate with one another and come up with a team approach. They were all trying different things, and one girl was actually standing over to the side and saying, yeah, you're not going to get me involved in this. And it was only when they finally lined up four on one side of Madison's shoulder and four on the other side and just kind of stood there with her and said, okay, come on. And then they all walked forward together, and she just walked right over. Well, it took them 45 minutes to get down to that. And so we gathered in a circle, the staff and the students. There were about 15 of us, and the horses were actually at the far end of the arena. They were nearly 60 or 80 feet away. But as we gathered, much to our surprise, Madison, the one who had been so sort of challenging, she came walking over and actually walked into the circle. So she was standing shoulder to shoulder with the rest of us. And we thought, we were just amused. And we said, well, let's just let her stand here, you know. And so the purpose of the circle was to kind of reflect on their experience. And so for maybe 10 minutes, we talked about, what had been the challenges, what did they learn, what was it difficult, So finally, I was concluding that session, and I began to tell them how Arabian horses in particular had been bred to live in the desert with the families. They were nomadic, and that Arabian horses actually lived in the tent. And as I said, the tents were often about the size of this circle that we're standing in. And as I said those words, Madison walked for the first time. She moved into the center of the circle. And we were all, it was kind of as though she was saying, like this, you know? And we were all just flabbergasted, you know, that she had been standing there hearing what we were saying at a level that none of us had really been aware of. And it was, of course, thrilling for all of us to realize that, these horses were attending to us in ways that we weren't necessarily even aware of. And, so that was a pretty special a moment for many of us.
Oh, yeah. And you have another story about that offers the difference between assertive partnership and aggression. and it was how Dollar morphed into being known as Foxfire.
Can yeah.
you talk to us about Dollar the horse?
Yeah. The difference between aggression and assertiveness is often something that my students especially needed to learn.
And I really respect the work of Cesar Millan, the dog whisperer. He talks about being the leader of the pack, and it's mm-hmm. sort of like that, isn't it?
It is. It is. it's being calm. He calls it calm and assertive, I believe, mm-hmm. something like that. And I, years before I got into therapeutic writing, it was one of my biggest challenges with girls, especially, to enable them to be assertive with a horse. And without them, because they would immediately say, "Oh, I'm being mean," you know, so they just wouldn't do it. And so, you know, obviously they'd been taught not to be aggressive, but they'd gotten that mixed up with what it meant to be assertive, symptomatic of our culture. And so, anyway, Dollar was a good example of how a horse really taught us, you know, that difference. I was looking for a new horse for the lesson program, and when I went to look at Dollar, I really wasn't looking for a pony so much, and I thought, you know, I wasn't really sure why I decided to go and look at him, but the minute I saw him trotting around the arena, I thought, this is the cutest pony, because he looked like a miniature horse, unlike most ponies. Most ponies have different proportions than a
stocky.
Horse.
Yeah.
You know, they're not built the same as a horse. But this guy, he was like a small horse, you know. And so that he was just real cute. And he was Palominos, so he was kind of glamorous looking. And so I took him on approval because he, the entire time I was observing him, he never walked once. And I got on his back and he was clearly so anxious. And I was told by the horse trader that he belonged to a 10-year-old girl who was afraid of him. And that the trainer who was a hunter jumper trainer had basically, her approach had been to discipline him. And he clearly was not responding well because he was one of the most nervous horses I'd seen. But there was something about him, that seemed sound as a dollar, as the guy said. And so, I proceeded over the next few weeks to become assertive with him, but not abusive, not to to provide discipline for him, but to do it in a calm and easy manner. And it took several days before I could ever get him to walk, you know, and I just did it by just sitting calmly on his back and asking him to walk, you know, but I also had to keep him away from jumps because there were jumps in the arena, but the minute I'd approach a jump, he'd just get really upset. And so this went on for, you know, a few weeks where I just calmly got him walking and but he still had, he was a little bit, you know, impish, and especially when we started putting students on his back, he had a very bad habit of suddenly veering into the middle, especially at a trot, and stopping very suddenly, and usually
he'd go flying, you know?
Yeah, often the student would fall off because he'd do it so quickly, and but he would never try that with an adult rider or a larger rider. He knew when he could get away with it. And so it became clear that I had to teach the students to become more assertive with him. And so it was wonderful to say, okay, you know, the instant he hints at pulling away from the group, that's, you've got to, you know, check him back with the rein, and you have to urge him forward with your legs and just get in your mind that he is going to move forward and insist on that with, you know, your legs, your voice, your body, and your being.
And with gentleness and patience.
Right. Because, you know, most of the kids would, like, you know, the minute he started to do that, they would screech and get scared. You know, these were like 7 and 8 year old kids.
Wow.
Because he was little. And so it was great, you know. I mean, these weren't beginning riders, of course. These were kids who had been riding for a few years, but.
But they were small people.
But they were small, and it wasn't beyond their capacity to do this because he was a little guy too. Mm-hmm. And so sure enough, it was an amazing transformation that, you know, it only took a few times before he got it that, oh, okay, I'm not going to be able to just get away with this. You know, it's like, okay, you know, and he'd just settle. As soon as he'd like test it, he'd settle in. Okay, fine. You know, he'd settle into the group. And he eventually, within a few months, became our most popular mount, even for beginners. And yeah. And he was a wonderful teacher of for all of us to see him. And, you know, another thing he did was he would, if we were riding him in around the barn area, he would run into his stall. And he even did that with me once. And I couldn't stop him because he could run sideways, you know, and... so we got, so we, you know, okay, what's a calm and assertive way to handle this? And so we just had someone lead him for maybe a year. If we were out in the barn area, we would just lead, someone be on his back, but he'd be led. And eventually he just sort of gave it up. You know, it was like, it wasn't a fun game anymore. He didn't need to be barn sour in such a dramatic way. Oh, and he got over that, you know. He really got over that and became a wonderful, bold and eager mount for kids. You know, he was so responsive. Mm-hmm. And once he decided he was going to play this game with us, you know, and play with us instead of against us.
So then he got the name of Foxfire instead.
Yeah, so we renamed him Foxfire. Uh-huh. And, you know, just as a coda to that, this was 15 years ago. I called my trainer just recently. She'd gone out, lived out of the country, and I finally contacted her, and she says, you know what? I moved my horses to this new facility, and you won't believe, but Foxfire is there. And I said, you're kidding. He must be 25 years old. She said, I'm sure he is, but he is great. The owner of the stable, he is his children's pony, and he looks just the same. And he's just
That's so cool.
Yeah, he's still around in San Antonio doing his job.
Doing his job.
Yeah.
Well, I got to do my job, and we have to take a short break. I'm Anthony Wright, and we are here with my guest, Trish Brarsma. And Trish has written a book, Riding Into Your Mythic Life. And how can people get a hold of you, Trish?
You can look at TrishBrorsma.com. That's TrishBrorsma, all one word, TrishBrorsma.com.
Well, we're going to take a short break and we'll be right back, so stay tuned. I'm Anthony Wright and I'm your host today on Attunement, and we are talking with my guest, Trish Brorsma. And Trish has written a book called Riding Into Your Mythic Life, Transformational Adventures with the Horse. Well, and before the break, Trish, we were talking about the horse now named Foxfire, mm-hmm. who had been a good teacher. What's the lifespan of a horse?
20 to 30 years.
Really?
You know, 30 is usually a really elderly horse, equivalent to a person who'd be around 90. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Although I've seen 35-year-old horses.
My goodness.
But that's unusual.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that Foxfire had done quite well was, and you write in your book about an energy communication exercise, about focused, coherent body communication, communication from a distance, which is what the girls were trying to do in bringing the horse over that low jump. But also, what is mimesis and imitation, and what's the difference?
Mimesis.
Uh-huh. Mimesis.
Yeah. This is a skill that any good professional actor has learned to master. And it basically has to do with putting yourself into the body of whoever it is that you're wanting to basically imitate. But it's the difference between enacting or repeating the movements of say you're going to imitate, what I talk about in the book is imitating a cat, because a cat is a natural predator of a horse, and if you're trying to get his attention, you can act like a cat. But if you're just sort of pretending to be a cat, like with a meow and maybe a hiss, and you know, putting one hand up like a claw, clawing. Well, you know, the horse is going to notice that you're not really into it, okay? And mimesis has to do with really stepping into the energy of the cat, like taking on your own catness. Like, what does it feel like deep down inside to be a cat? And so that it's like you take on that sinuous energy of the cat, the movement, and really become a cat as much as a human being can. And so it's calling on a deeper form of imagining. It's like taking it into your body and in your deeper imagination, so that when you hiss and rise up like a cat, your horse notices, because they notice that shift in your energy, that you're not just pretending, that you've really taken on catness. And that's, you know, that's their predator. That's something they're going to perk up. Their eyes are, their ears are going to come forward and snort, you know, that sort of thing. And yeah, you know, it's not done with the idea of being really going after them as a predator, but just to get their attention, you know. Mm-hmm. At least that's the way a friend of mine utilized it for her, because she had a horse who really was just being very adolescent and boisterous and not listening to her at all. Even though she was a very experienced horse person and trainer, this horse was just running around and bucking and just paying no attention to her at all for 20 or 30 minutes. And
that's a long time.
Yeah, it was a long time, but this horse was young and exuberant, and she could not get the horse's attention. And her trainer suggested, you know, be a cat. And it was only when she was able to really step into that mimesis of being the cat that she, all of a sudden her horse stopped immediately, snorted, like, oh, okay, you got my attention.
I guess so.
And then the conversation was able to start. So it was like she was using that as a way to create the partnership with the horse. You know, the horse was really not at all interested in partnership at that point. And so, you know, it's like she was asking, saying, come on, let's get on an equal ground here.
Before we began our interview, we talked about Violet Emerald, your beloved teacher. Mm-hmm. and did Violet Emerald teach you about horseness?
You know, she taught me a lot of things. And I want to say, I think all of my horses have taught me things about horseness. And I think the particular quality that she taught me, and frankly still does, is a kind of calm and grounded approach to things. That in some ways I feel like she's at my side even right now as we're speaking, and has been since her death a few years ago. But even before that, she had a way of a calm way of approaching things. Not that she wouldn't shy at something on the trail or assert an opinion about things, but there was a sort of welcoming, like in particular, she had this unusual quality of eagerly heading away from the barn on a trail ride, for instance, and then slowing down when she came back, which she is really the only horse I've ever experienced that
it's
with.
It's usually the opposite.
Right. It's usually the opposite, that a horse will be, it's basically considered part of their nature to be herd bound. Right. But with Emerald, even as a young horse, she would eagerly trot away from the barn. And I think I really appreciated that enthusiasm for life's adventure. Mm-hmm. It always amused me that she would slow down going back to the barn. In fact, it was actually very helpful. One time when I was training her, we were trotting along a trail out in the park, and we came upon a bridge, and it startled her. And we were cantering, actually, and she startled and jumped to the side, and I fell off. And so she went running off, and she was the way she was running off was back towards the barn. And I knew that she was going to be crossing a busy street. And so I was really frightened. And I started running after her, which you wouldn't normally do, but I thought, you know. But the fact that she suddenly realized she was going back to the barn, she really didn't particularly like going to the barn, is what saved it. I could see her stop and say, wait a minute, I don't want to go back to the barn.
Right.
And so in that moment, I was able to approach her and catch her, you know.
But in a manner of speaking, it sounded like she was responding in embarrassment, actually, a little bit.
Yeah, she probably was, you know.
But we're talking about energy, communication, and the expanded self, and expanding the boundaries of your awareness. And can you talk to us about that? Because she really invited you to do that.
Yes, she did. Again, I think many of the other horses as well taught me that. Mm-hmm. And it starts as simply as the fact that the horse notices things out on a trail ride that I might not notice. In the environment, you know, the particular way things look, so that, you know, in order to ride wisely with my horse, I had to start noticing those things as well. It's as simple as that. But it also happens, it would happen in such things as I would arrive after maybe a stressful meeting or whatever, and find that my ride wasn't going so well. Because basically she had picked up on what was going on for me, that I was, you know, maybe had a headache or I was upset, and it was maybe outwardly doing much the same thing that I'd done the day before with her, the subtle differences in my demeanor were meaningful to her, and so it was like I needed to look inside and notice how a subtle way I was communicating something to her that I maybe didn't intend, mm-hmm. but that we had a communication on a much more profound level than I had been aware of, you know, and that I had to attend to that, you know.
Well, we have to attend to taking a short break, I'm sorry to say, because this is a wonderful conversation. I appreciate you're being my guest, and I'm talking with my guest, Trish Broersma, and Trish has written a book called Riding Into Your Mythic Life, Transformational Adventures with the Horse. And how can people get a hold of you, Trish?
At trishbroersma.com, that's TRISHBROERSMA.
Great, we'll take a short break, and we'll be right back, so stay tuned. I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and we are talking with my guest, Trish Broersma. And Trish has written a book called Riding Into Your Mythic Life, Transformational Adventures with the Horse. And before the break, Trish, we were talking about attuning to a deeper level of communication with the horse. And one of the things that you speak to in your book is about expanding the boundaries of awareness, and also quantum non-locality, about that we're connected through intention, and the work of, this follows the work of Rupert Sheldrake. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about that.
that's one of the things that I find the most fascinating is how there does seem to be some parallel universe out there, or a level of communication, a level of reality that we all participate in. And I actually sometimes feel like the that non-local world is sometimes being supported by the internet. It's given more form, more physical form. It exists in the world of subtle energy, that we communicate with one another in ways that are far beyond our normal reckoning, and we are a part of one another's world in ways that we don't necessarily always keep in mind. And I remember one time. Someone even told me that I had been out of town for quite a while at one point, and my horse Beau, who is Emerald's son, was stabled at a nearby stable, and they, the next day when I came out, they says, did you come back into town around 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon? And I said, well, yeah, I did, but I wasn't able to get out to the barn. They says, I knew it. They said, Bo started jumping around in his stall right about that time. And it was like, we just knew that you were in the area. And, but in a, you know, more, perhaps more touching story, it has to do with Emerald's demise, really. In the last years that I had Emerald, she had developed arthritis quite severely. And I'd never really, I'd had to euthanize horses, but it was always in real clear circumstances where there was something acute going on. But in her case, it was unclear to me at what point would be humane to, you know, euthanize her with this arthritis that was becoming more and more severe. And my veterinarian said, you know, you'll know. He says, don't worry about it. You'll know. And so I just kind of rested in that. I trusted that. So 1 weekend I was up in Portland, and I was with a friend who I was standing next to her, and she was getting ready to do a dance. And if, someone that she hadn't even known, actually, and I didn't know her either, she approached my friend and said, I thought you might like this drum for your dance, and it's made out of a horse hide. And I, as she said those words, I was suddenly struck with this knowledge with such certainty that it was overwhelming, that it was time for Emerald to be euthanized, and also that I needed to make a drum out of her hide, which if anyone even an hour before had suggested to me, I would have thought it was the most macabre suggestion in the world. Mm-hmm. But in this context, it came with such certainty that it would have been really inappropriate for me not to honor it.
And you're talking about a drum that's a shallow shallow shell drum that's like a shaman's drum.
Mm-hmm, that's right. And when I arrived home on Monday morning, I got a call before I was able to get out to Emerald's pasture, and gentleman was saying, you know, she's walking in a circle in an odd way. And so I thought, no. because I had figured I was going to have a week of special time with her. And so I drove out to the pasture and quickly realized that she had suffered a stroke sometime in the previous time. And I'm sure that that's what I had tuned into, you know, that even though I was, you know, several hundred miles away, some part of me knew that it was her time. And certainly she was afraid, and it was cold and rainy. It was in this time of the year, exactly this time of the year, in December. And I knew that she needed to go. And so the last chapter of my book is really goes into detail about that didn't quite turn out the way I had expected that experience.
I'm glad you weren't seriously hurt.
She ended up falling on me and so forth. But nevertheless, there was that communication between us that, you know, it is certainly evidence of that non-local reality that we often are not so much aware of.
You know, there's a part, because we're coming to the end of the show here, and there's a part of your book that I'd like to ask you to read.
Yeah, the message I got from Turtle. The essential work of writing into your mythic life is to encourage a radical, fundamental reorientation of ourselves to the world around us. Work with horses accomplishes this by giving us experiences that connect us with our higher selves. It energizes us for pursuing our greatest dreams and hopes. We come to treat everything as sentient. We participate in growing a membrane that is a kind of web embracing the earth, increasing in density and activating new consciousness. We understand how things fit together in one great story, a story of evolution of a new era. We join with other great specialists of spirit who are leading people into their full potential. We become pilgrims of the future, each here to bring some dream into reality by living our own journey to the fullest. The turtle tells me to remember, to slow down, and engage this deeper purpose of my partnership with horses. It's funny, being a horse person, that turtle started showing up in dreams and in real life as a guide for me, an animal guide, animal ally.
And also, I think it's real important to mention a couple things about the North American Riding for Handicapped Association and the Equine
Yes.
Facilitated Mental Health Association.
Yes.
Can you tell us just in the last moment or two about
Yes.
your work with them?
Yes. Well, NARA is a association, nonprofit, developed to provide standards of professionalism and safety for people in the therapeutic riding field. They accredit programs for those standards, and they also certify instructors and provide a lot of training for people in the field. The Equine Facilitated Mental Health Association is a section of NARA, and I just recently took over the presidency of that. And our mission is
congratulations.
Thank you. Our mission is to work with people who are in the fields of education or psychotherapy or coaching, any field where they want to attend to the broader issues of body, mind, and spirit in that therapeutic writing setting.
Well, that's quite remarkable, and I'm so sorry to say we are out of time.
It seems very brief, and yet.
Oh, yes. But,
wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, you're most welcome, and it's been a real blessing to talk with you. We're speaking with my guest, Trish Broersma, and Trish has written a book called Riding Into Your Mythic Life, Transformational Adventures with the Horse. And how can people get a hold of you, Trish?
They can go to my website at trishbroersma.com, T-R-I-S-H-B-R-O-E-R-S-M-A.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being with us. I'm Anthony Wright, and I've been your host today on Attunement. And thanks for listening, and see you next time.